The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, plus a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Katie Balls and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Isabel Hardman. And we're all celebrating after being shortlisted for a podcast award. How's everyone feeling, Isabel? What have you been doing since the news broke?
I'm just delighted. I've been preparing my thanks to my family, to God, to loyal fans of this podcast, particularly those who think that we have names that aren't actually our own, that those are our favourite fans.
Yeah, exactly. James, anything you want to tell us about your celebrations since the news broke that we've made it onto a shortlist for the first time on this podcast history?
Well, I think we should thank our producers, Cindy, you and Max, who do such a remarkably good job of turning our audio into kind of listenable quality. And I suppose, in a way, it's kind of an interesting thing. It's been very odd because so much of how we used to do it was everyone kind of sitting around in the office, and now we're all doing it from three different locations. So it'd be very good to all get back to being in the same place.
Yes, indeed. And it's probably enough talking about ourselves. So let's talk about a politician who's set the cat amongst the pigeons with his own video, which some said was self-focused, others said was a great piece of communication. It's Rishi Sunak. Tomorrow is his budget. And here's a clip from his video, complete with orchestral music.
I'll never forget, the team said, oh, you've got to have a call. There are someone called Chris Whitty and Patrick Vallance. Sitting in the Treasury in my office around the big table with their team, where they very calmly and methodically walked me through everything that they were seeing. And I remember when we finished the call, there was just silence.
Our planned economic response will be one of the most comprehensive in the world.
Once we knew we were going to have to lock down huge parts of the country, we knew we would have to do something equally radical to try and protect people's jobs.
Isabel, you've written before about Rishi Sunak's graphics, his brand Rishi. Do you think we're going to be seeing more of this in tomorrow's budget?
Yes, and I think there's probably more work that needs to go into this as well, because brand Rishi was quite easy to sell in the first few months of the pandemic, where he was giving out lots of nice things to keep businesses going and keep people in their jobs. It's a little bit harder now that he's having to make decisions that some of his Tory colleagues are disagreeing with. He's obviously announcing extensions to certain schemes, but he's running out of road for handing things out. And so brand Rishi, to stay nice and sort of lovable and this kind of glossy brand that he's created over the past year, is going to have to work really, really hard to prevent him from becoming what normally chancellors are, which are people who look quite mean and hold on to the purse strings. I think this is the first time, certainly in the time that I've been covering politics, that a chancellor has wanted to come across as nice. Most chancellors are quite happy with their sort of deputy headmaster image.
James, there's been a lot in terms of pitch rolling to suggest this budget is not going to be a bunny budget. It's going to be a budget with lots of difficult measures, or at least a couple of difficult measures. But there is still some positive news seeping out. So what are the bright stories that we're expecting to come from tomorrow?
So we had overnight, we've had kind of more money to kind of keep sports going without, you know, because obviously they can't be certain of having fans in stadiums until after June 21st. And even then, social distancing restrictions might still remain in place. You know, the government have essentially parked that big decision in a review. There's more money for culture and art. I think one of the things that strikes me about tomorrow is this shift to having a televised press conference just hours after the budget has finished. And I think it does indicate an interesting willingness to kind of go and aggressively make the case for these measures, which, as Isabel said, which are not all going to be popular in the way that the measures taken, you know, in the height of a crisis, which were purely about providing support, were.
Now, Isabel, as James mentions, we are going to be having a press conference or an audience with Rishi, with journalists and members of the public soon after the budget. And then after that, he is going to be addressing the 1922 committee. Where do you think his toughest audience is in terms of this budget? It seems that when you look at polling, the public at least say they are more open to tax rises. But when you look at the Tory party, quite a lot of hostility building.
Yeah, I think the 1922 committee is going to be much harder than his In Conversation with Rishi Sunak, which I hope is going to take place on those impossibly high chairs that you always think someone's going to fall off against a sort of black backdrop, maybe again with some soothing music. Conservative MPs are very anxious about the idea that he could be raising some taxes. There's other Conservatives such as Philip Hammond, who has again been warning about the danger of choking off the recovery before it has begun. And you also have Conservative MPs who throughout this pandemic have been a little bit anxious about the way in which their party has had to become really what they would describe as Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party in terms of its spending model. That was something that was an early complaint when Rishi Sunak was handing out lots of money for the furlough scheme and so on. And you will get complaints from certain wings of the party that the Chancellor, you know, he might be talking tough, but he still isn't turning the spending taps off just yet. So he's got complaints from either side on this. And he also has MPs who are anxious about the £20 uplift in universal credit, which is something that Labour is campaigning on quite hard and something that MPs across the political spectrum are getting a lot of letters about in their constituency postbags. So he is going to have a tough audience, and there's less goodwill towards him from the party than there was certainly a year ago.
But James, one of the things helping Rishi Sunak is the fact that the vaccine rollout is going to plan, so you can start to see how you could forge a path back to, I want to say normality, but at least something near to normality, and therefore the economy opening up. When it comes to the vaccine news, we had some good news yesterday on the Oxford vaccine. Can you talk us through this?
Yeah, the good news is that one dose of either the Oxford vaccine or the Pfizer vaccine is 80% effective in preventing hospitalisation among the over 80s, the group most vulnerable to COVID. And I think that is a higher level of efficacy from one dose than had been expected. Also, interestingly, among the over 70s, you know, now the confidence intervals on this are quite large, so we should tread cautiously. But again, the Oxford vaccine is as, if not maybe slightly more effective than the Pfizer vaccine in preventing infections. Now, I think this is a double moment of relief for the UK government, because first of all, the Oxford vaccine, the trial data was quite messy and it didn't look as good as Pfizer in the trials. This suggests that in the real world, it is as good as Pfizer. And it also acts as a kind of vindication of the one dose strategy that the government have been pursuing, you know, separating out the doses. And I think, you know, you can tell from the fact that the French, where Emmanuel Macron famously said that AstraZeneca was quasi ineffective on the over 65s, they are now saying, no, it can now be used on the over 65s. They have been pushed into a U-turn by the fact that both the Public Health England data and the Public Health Scotland data suggest it is highly efficacious. You combine that with the government's confidence about vaccine supplies over the coming months, and crucially, that take-up is much higher than expected. And all of this suggests that the scenario is going to be quite a bit better than the SAGE modelling expected, because not only are the vaccines doing a better job, but also more people are taking the vaccines.
Isabel, are we seeing a vindication of the government strategy so far in terms of, first off, there was criticism from some domestically, but particularly, I think, if you looked at the foreign press over the decision to space out the two doses. And there was also criticism from figures such as Emmanuel Macron about the Oxford vaccine in the over 65s. This idea was quasi ineffective. So is this a victory for the government, even if they don't want to call it that?
Yes, I think it is. And you wrote about this last night on Coffee House, as did Mr. Steerpike, in terms of the way in which EU leaders have really shown themselves up with some of their bizarre comments on this. And one of the criticisms that Boris Johnson has had a lot from his party is that he's too keen to follow the science. He doesn't think about the wider picture on lockdown restrictions. But it's fair to say that following the science on the vaccine has worked out pretty well for the government so far, I think. And the sort of political implications of this are really interesting as well, because obviously the start of the pandemic and the death toll in the UK have been not at all a vindication of the way in which ministers approached COVID. But the vaccination programme may well mean that they have a better exit politically from this pandemic than they probably deserve overall. I think also one of the other things that's really important, and we talk a lot about the progress of the vaccine programme, suggesting that restrictions might be able to be lifted earlier and so on. But it also gives ministers a little bit more space to start thinking about the recovery from COVID. So in terms of the NHS backlog of operations, of treatment, of diagnostics and so on, in terms of school children who are obviously going back to the classroom in the next few days, there's a huge amount of work that needs to be done there. And rather than preparing for another, you know, 6 months of chaos and remote learning and people are having to cancel a lot of elective work in the NHS, ministers can really start to plan properly now for the very long and very difficult programme of recovering from the damage that the pandemic has done to wider society.
And James, just finally, as well, touched on the return of pupils to school due next Monday. How risky do you think this is in terms of the government's COVID strategy? We know how important it is to get children back to school in terms of the effect of lost learning, particularly on inequality. But just in terms of where they think want things to go and the infection rates, is this a trouble point?
So I think it's been kind of, the government have repeatedly said that, you know, their priority was getting kids back to school. I think, you know, that you could argue it is a risk doing all the years at once, but I think it is a risk worth taking given the educational damage that has been inflicted and the kind of social damage too. I also think it is worth noting that the Easter holidays come quite quickly after children return to school, so there is a kind of natural break in the progress. And also, I think you come back to this point that we discussed in this podcast before, you know, slightly, what is the point of the vaccination programme if it is not to drive towards greater levels of normality? And it is worth remembering that until relatively recently, you know, there was talk of only vaccinating those first 9 groups. That's about half the population. You know, you have now vaccinated all the over 80-year-olds, the most at-risk group. The antibody data coming out suggests that, you know, shows the way in which that is taking effect. And I think various studies also suggest that teachers are not at any particular greater risk than the general population. And also, we know that this virus, you know, thankfully, doesn't affect children particularly badly.
Thank you, James. Thank you, Isabel. And thank you for listening.